everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and welcome to the Audio Jazz Experience. I am pleased to be on the phone here with Orrin Evans, the incredible pianist. You've known him as a solo artist. You've probably heard and seen him perform with a myriad of groups. Currently, obviously, you've heard him performing lately with the Bad Plus when he's not performing his own stuff, but he is coming into Chicago at the Green Mill, the legendary jazz spot here in Chicago, 4802 North Broadway, greenmilljazz.com. He's coming in March 13th and 14th, and we were able to catch up with him in between his busy schedule and hopefully preview what he's got coming up here and what we can expect to hear at the Green Mill. So, Orrin, thanks so much for jumping on for a minute.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit specifically right out of the bat, because obviously you're touring with the Bad Plus and you're also touring with your own trio. So you're coming in the Green Mill March 13th and 14th, and I know you've played there many times before. So why don't we talk a little bit about who's going to be joining you this time at the Green Mill?
Well, this time I have Gene Jackson on drums, one of my good friends, and it's just always a pleasure to play music with him. He lives in Japan full time pretty much now, but then comes to town around this time every year, twice a year. And I always just try to make sure I get an opportunity to play with him. So I'm really excited that he was available for this. And then on bass, Lucas Curtis, who's joined me at Green Mill a few times now, pretty much probably not, if not all, he's been there a good portion of the times that I've played at the Green Mill. And I always do March because it's a birthday celebration for me. This year, I'm coming earlier. Mm-hmm. My birthday's March 28th, and I'm coming earlier because the Bad Plus will be out on the road during the time of my birthday. So I want to still try to get in and do something at Green Mill. And I just love the energy and the vibe, and Dave is just good people.
Yeah, you've got to love Dave Gemmelo, that's for sure. and yep. You know, the thing with the Mill, and especially, I mean, now, you know, all of the different things you've done throughout your entire career, you've played in all these different clubs throughout the entire world and larger venues, theaters and small clubs and everything else. But what is it about the Green Mill? Because I know you've been in town a bunch of times, as you mentioned, usually around this time in March. But I mean, what is it about the Mill that kind of stands out from some of the other clubs maybe you perform in?
I don't know if it stands out or it's different. It's just in what it is for me. It's kind of nostalgic because I grew up in Philadelphia and it reminds me of one of my favorite places to play in Philly, called Ortlieb's, that closed years ago. Not years, but at least they've been closed, man, almost 15 years now, which is really strange.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy playing there. It was a place where you can go in. It was like Cheers of jazz, you know, go in there, like meet your name. There was nothing, the bathroom, you definitely didn't want to stay longer than you had to, you know, which is definitely the Green Mill bathroom. You want to get in and get out. It's just a really cool spot. Everybody that works there, and then hearing Chris play organ before you play, it's just a home. It's really, really down home. You know what I mean? I know some people really like the classy, blah blah blah. There's a place for that too. Mm-hmm. You know, but I need places like Green Mill to stay around because, you know, it's real. It's real. It's just a real place to be.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up, like, you know, growing up in Philly and stuff. Obviously, there's been so many incredible jazz musicians coming out of Philly. I mean, you know, we could sit here for 3 hours and talk about that. But, you know, I'm convinced because I myself, you know, I'm a jazz musician as well, and along with owning the magazine and everything. But Playing in those clubs and playing like small clubs like this, and as a musician yourself coming up, I mean, you're used to hanging out. That's how you learned your chops and got your chops, is playing in small clubs and hanging out and talking to musicians and having that back and forth. And it's probably nice because now that, you know, you're touring with the Bad Plus and you guys are playing some theaters and doing different things like that, it's a different vibe. So for you to be able to come and just kind of hang in a club, be with everybody, just kind of chill out, play, it's got to bring you back to your roots a little bit as well, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, and that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. I mean, even when I'm in Chicago, if I'm not playing at the Green Mill, I try to always make it a point to stop by. Mm-hmm. Although Chicago is huge and it just takes forever to get around. I always thought Philly was huge. I'm just like, Chicago is huge. So depends on where, you know, where you're playing. And if I have time to get over to the Green Mill, but I try to always do it because it's just visiting home. It's like, you know, it's like that feeling like when you graduate school and you go back and visit.
Yeah.
You know, you get to walk to all. The only thing is you only do that for 2 years and you don't do it anymore. This, I'm going to do it the rest of my life.
Well, let's talk about what people can expect to hear at the Green Mill, because, you know, looking over your whole career, and it's probably changed since the last time I read something, but I think you were on like over 25, 26 recordings, either you're leading it or as a, you know, as a part of the group. And I know that we talked before we jumped on the phone, you've got a couple of recent releases, right? So you've got the big band release, which is out already, but it's Knowing is Half the Battle, and this is like an all-star cast here, so we can talk about that. And then we talked a little bit too before we jumped on about The Evolution of Oneself, and that's more of a trio record. So what are people going to be able to expect to experience when they come March 13th and 14th?
Gotcha. Well, actually, the big band record is called Presence, and that was actually Grammy nominated.
Oh, you know what? I'm looking at your website, and it's right above the one I was just looking at, because there's so many musicians on that other one. I was thinking that was the one, but yeah, I'm sorry. Presence. Yeah, it was Grammy nominated. Congratulations.
Thank you. And Knowing is Half the Battle was, you know, I've never recorded on any project of mine. Just trying to make sure before I misquote myself. with a guitar player, and it was a voice I hadn't really tried to deal with yet. Along with that is vibraphones. I've recorded with and played with a bunch of great vibraphones, so I just never had any on my record. So on Evolution of Oneself, I asked Marvin Sewell to play one tune, and from that I was like, no, I think he played two tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And from that I was like, okay, I gotta really try to deal with this. So then Kevin Eubanks and Kurt Rosenwinkel graciously agreed to do that record. Then we did Presence, which was a live record. And so I guess to answer your question, I don't know, you know, what to expect. What I do know is that there's 90% of the time I'm sharing the bandstand with friends, brothers, sisters, family.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is, no matter what, whether it's the big band or not, it's just to embrace that family reunion kind of vibe. And may we have another, our fourth big band record coming out, and it was pretty much that vibe. Just everyone getting together. The music is already, we live every day to play the music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, granted, if I write new music, we deal with that accordingly, but the real essence of what I would love everyone to get before they leave is to look at that bandstand and say, man, those guys really love each other. They really appreciate each other on and off the bandstand.
Mm-hmm.
And if the audience sees that and we feel that on the bandstand, then nothing can go wrong, you know?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I think you're a perfect person to talk about that because, you know, you go through as you're coming up as a musician, you're coming up and, you know, you've got to play those gigs or be on those bandstands with people maybe you're not exactly in love with all the time, right? But you're dealing with it. You're making it happen. You're making the best of the whole situation. But when you get into a situation where you are now and you've done so much, I guess you actually – You can make the call, right? I mean, you get to play with the people you really actually love playing with, which actually probably really helps even expand your creativity even more, right? You continuously can grow if you're not having any sort of, you know, power play on the bandstand or there isn't any angst happening. I'm sure that's probably one of the reasons too. But I mean, you're in a situation now where you get to actually play with a lot of people that you really just want to play with.
Yeah, I mean. Well, one part of that is it was a conscious decision at one point to really be a leader mm-hmm. and lead my own ensembles. And that, I think, comes just from an entrepreneurial spirit I've always had. You know, I mean, whether it was selling cookies or selling candy or whatever, I just always enjoyed making my own money. Mm-hmm. And so when it came to music, I was like, well, how can I apply that to this? And it wasn't so much that I was playing with people that I, quote unquote, didn't like. It was just that I really enjoyed hosting the party myself.
Ah, okay.
And that's not an easy thing to do. There's a lot. This is not, you know, I mean, you know, it's not easy to do because you got to eat, mm-hmm. you know, and I took a lot of risk and still do to this day. I mean, when I moved back to Philly, one of the things I moved to New York, then I moved back to Philly, when my second son was born mm-hmm. and just to be close to family, babysitter, school district, all that good stuff.
Sure.
So when we came back, I immediately realized that I had to change some of the things I was doing in order to really maintain the path that I wanted to stay on. And you know, like, so for example, I threw away my keyboard and I was just like, mm-hmm. I don't want a keyboard because the minute you have a keyboard for me,
right.
The more likely you are to do, somebody calls you and say, hey man, I got this hotel gig, which is a great gig, nothing against it, but mm-hmm. I just didn't want to do it. So I was like, you know what? I have to not have my keyboard, you know, and make it a lifestyle change. I'm not going on a diet. I'm mm-hmm. just not going to play keyboards. And, you know, and if I play them now on the road, if I play them, I mean, I definitely, it's on the rider and I'm not carrying it.
Yeah, but, yeah right.
You know, and those are like leader decisions that everybody doesn't always understand. But once you decide that this is what I want to do and this is what I don't want to do, you got to stick to it.
Well, I think too, and it's interesting that you said that because obviously I, you know, entrepreneurial stuff. I mean, that's, you know, I own the magazine. I started the magazine, all that stuff. And then also just being a musician and booking gigs and contracting and getting people to the place and bringing the band in or coming into Chicago to play at the Green Mill. There's all these different levels of stuff. And, you know, it's interesting because when you got rid of your keyboard, you're not saying you got rid of your keyboard because you're like, I hate everybody that plays a keyboard. You got rid of your keyboard because you don't want to have to even worry about getting tempted to take other gigs because you knew where you wanted to go and you knew how you had to get there. And that was the direction you wanted to go. And that's what you needed to do, which makes total sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't learn a lot of this stuff in music school, do you?
Not at all.
So what were growing up in Philly, since we're talking a little bit about this, now you're back in Philly. What a rich town, right? I mean, with music and everything. I mean, who were some of your influences in Philly itself coming up? I mean, there had to be some musicians that you would go hang out and check out all the time that people would probably know coming out of Philly, right?
Without a doubt. I mean, the sad thing is a huge portion of the elders are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, a huge portion of the people that I grew up listening to in Philly, like Shirley Scott, Trudy Pitts, Nikki Roker, Bobby Dorham, there's some of the other younger ones that are still here, thank God, Mike Boone, mm-hmm. And those people were really supportive and instrumental in my development.
Yeah. Well, what was the scene like? Because, you know, we have a lot of music students that listen to this, obviously a lot of jazz fans, but a lot of music students are listening to the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience here, the podcast. And I always like to kind of relate it back. And when I'm talking to somebody like you who's done so much with their career and is leading a group specifically, I mean, what was that scene like back then? I mean, obviously it was probably welcoming, but then there was probably like that pushback, like you're up on a bandstand, and I'm sure some of the elder statesmen would take you aside or maybe in front of everybody and tell you, you know, you really need to learn your tunes, man. You need to work on this stuff. I mean, that's part of that jazz musician development, isn't it?
You know, I'm probably going to make a lot of enemies right now, but I wish, you know, Philly, ironically is clearly the city of brotherly love. But the problem with that is you can come to Philly and find your, where you fit in, stay there and be there for your entire life. Hmm. And with that, and that's not, I mean, make a career, see something like nothing, you know, that's not what I wanted to do, but you can do it. And what you do is you find a group of people that will not tell you how they feel. Because that wasn't always looked on as the way to getting better. You know, it was more of a coddling Philly, and it's gotten worse, to be honest. It's turned into this coddling thing. And what I realized, like some of the younger ones after me that went on to New York and didn't stay in Philly, it was a culture shock. It was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, he just told me I wasn't playing my scales right. Oh, he just told me I need to learn the key signature. Man, you won't believe what this man told me at Smalls or blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, good. You know, that's, you know, it's no different than you're playing football and the coach is on the side yelling at you, you know, or you're playing basketball and you're like, you're trying to win the game. Mm-hmm. So I always wanted that. And to some extent, that's why I moved to New York. Because as a younger man, I didn't get it in Philly as much. I mean, I had a lot of support. People who were nice, people who came out, you know. But then I also had a few, if any, I had some that they weren't into original music, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, if I didn't play A-Train every set, I was doing something wrong, you know. But to answer your question, people like Arthur Harper, who played with Wes Montgomery and J.J. Johnson, who was from Philly and lived here, was always the one to tell me exactly how he felt, and I always appreciated it. Mm-hmm. You know, or Johnny Coles. Johnny Coles would always say something. Shirley Scott, you know, but those three people had seen the world. You know, that's a different energy. But then there was a bunch of them that were so nice all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of caught in this nice guy world where that's more appreciated. You know, think about how many people say, oh, he's such a nice guy, you know? And I was like, okay, that's good. I like the nice guy. I mean, that's good. We need nice guys, but, and girls, but yeah. We also need somebody that's going to tell you what it's like. And I got more of that by moving to New York. And I mean, some of my first gigs with Hammy and Blewett, I always appreciated his honesty, mm-hmm. and straightforwardness. Or Bobby Watson, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and I don't mean it to sound like Philly wasn't and isn't an important part of my trajectory, but there were a lot of things that I had to leave Philly and leave the comforts of everyone telling me I was good to find out how good I wasn't.
Well, you know, you and I are right around that same age, and I feel like we were coming up in that same age where, you know, the people that were playing were still the people that were playing that were old enough that used to get a lot of crap from a lot of people that they were listening to back in the day. So they would share that with you, you know, I mean, but then it was the other people that were there. Cause it was almost like, you know, in our 40s, we're kind of like in that back and forth era where we were experiencing and dealing with and playing with some of the old timers that would tell you exactly what had to happen. Cause that's how they learned. And then you were dealing with some of the newer people or the younger people that didn't have that experience and just wanted to kind of make sure everybody felt good. So everybody kept coming back and kept learning together and stuff. And I feel like you're spot on with understanding and being self-aware enough to say, hey, you know what? I need to go to New York to get another perspective on this. Cause to me, when you go to New York from Philly or when you go to New York from Chicago, I mean, you walk into New York and there's so many people there, but the fact that if they think that you're good enough, they'll tell you exactly what you're doing wrong. And that's a big thank you to them because that's how you grow as a musician and can really, you know, understand what's out there in the world. It sounds like that's exactly what happened to you, which is why you're where you are now.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about these recordings now. Now you've got, you know, up for a Grammy with Presence and, all of this, by the way, is available on OrinEvansMusic.com. And then you've got Knowing is Half the Battle, and that's the guitar. I guess it's pretty much all guitar players for the most part and some vibe players. And then you've got The Evolution of Oneself. And these came out kind of consecutively, maybe one year after another. But it's interesting because to me, all of these are just different conceptually. I mean, is this stuff that you sit around and you try to formulate creatively what you're going to do and how you're going to put groups together to come up with something that's different from the last thing you did when you go into a recording?
I kind of just try to, I hope the people's personalities are what's going to make it different. Mm-hmm. And that is probably why, and especially the drummer. And that's probably why, you know, which is hard for me because every time I find a drummer I love, when I switch to a new drummer, I never want the other drummer's feelings to be hurt.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, and it's in no way like I'm out here with a million gigs a year or anything like that. But I don't want that feeling. But the reason I switched to drummers a lot is just they're really the people to me who color the record. Mm. Just how they decide to interpret my songs. And I'm not very specific. You know, like I'll write the music, but I'm never, I don't go over and say, this is how this should be, play this beat, maybe one or two songs. But really, I'm just like, well, you know, how do you hear that? You know, play it. Let's see. Mm-hmm. And then I really like to hear what each drummer plays, you know, and just making sure that they're comfortable and they are really who shape the direction, the sound, the vibe of the record. And then continuing, and next in the order for me is the horn player, depending on whether I use a saxophonist or a trumpet player, that person helping me shape the sound. So all the records, it's pretty much all the same quote-unquote people that I hang with in the village, but I really try to keep the drummer so I can always think of something new to play. I really communicate with percussionists, and I just want them to inspire me, and I always get that out of people like Nasheed Waits, Donald Edwards, Mark Whitfield Jr., and Ralph Peterson, Gene Jackson. Just so it's great to have all, you know, that little group of that huge group of drummers that can help me shape the music, and I think that's what makes the record sound different. Because sometimes there's a repeat of the songs, mm-hmm. you know, not all the time, but sometimes some of the songs are repeated, and I do that just one. Why can't I create new standards? You know, everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, we all play Autumn Leaves. Why can't one of my tunes be a standard one day?
Yeah. Right. Well,
you know,
I think it's interesting. As a piano player, I think it's interesting you're bringing up the drummer. I would have thought, by the way, I'm a drummer, so I'm all about it now, you know. But I thought it would have been maybe a bass player for the harmonics, but the drumming makes sense because it you're right. You could play the same tune with a different drummer, and it would be a different vibe.
Right.
And that would change the way maybe you play or interpret something.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. So I'm assuming for your gigs coming up here at the Green Mill on March 13th and 14th, by the way, greenmilljazz.com, 4802 North Broadway, Chicago. And as Dave Gemmelo always says, all roads lead to Uptown. So that's his tagline since the Green Mill is in Uptown. So for this trio, you're going to be up there, and I'm assuming you're just going to kind of pick tunes, probably play a lot of original tunes and put something together that is kind of a mixture of everything that you've recorded over the past bunch of years.
Basically, you know, I mean, when I like to be stress-free, so Gene has recorded with me on a few records. He's done, maybe he's on my big band record, he's on my record 20 years ago. And so I probably will pick some tunes from those, which is fun for me because I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't played these in a while. And it's funny because I have a gig this weekend and I was doing the set list. And my goal is to, you know, not have to print music all the time I don't have a folder with all the music. It's just too hard. It's too thick. It's too hard. So I just change it up. But I wanted to put a set list together now in February for all the gigs that I have going up until June and just said, man, let me just deal with these songs. That's all I'm going to play. But every time I sit down to do that, I remember, oh man, I love the way Gene plays this. You know what I mean? Or I love the way, you know, I have a gig this coming up, not until the summer, but with Nasheed Waits and Buster Williams. I'm like, oh man, I would love to hear Buster play this. You know, so I basically will go through and just go through the archives and say, all right, well, you know, I also will throw in one of their tunes. You know, sometimes if some of the people in the band have tunes, I throw those in there. You know, it just kind of depends, you know, and as much as I try to prepare to do it ahead of time, which I have done sometimes that week of, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I should play this song. Go in there. So, I mean, really, to be honest, Luquez has been playing with me now 14 years, and Gene Jackson 20. So there's a bunch of music we can pull from.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, I guess the only way people can hear it is they're going to have to go to the Green Mill then March 13th and 14th. Of course, Friday night the show is at 9 p.m. and then Saturday night is at 8 p.m. greenmilljazz.com. Of course, all the information on Orrin Evans can be found on his website, orrinevansmusic.com. All of his different shows, all of the recordings, everything is available there. Orrin, I really appreciate you being on with me today. I have one more quick question because I have to ask this. I'm looking through your upcoming shows, and I'm looking April 17th at the X-Zero Jazz Fest. You're playing with Joey DeFrancesco. Is that both of you on stage together?
Yeah.
Whoa.
About three years ago, I put together something here in Philly where Joey and I brought a good friend of ours, a drummer by the name of John Roberts, and we had a Philly bass player, and we did like what we called a Philly reunion. It was just going back to some of those days growing up. And then from that, they recently just put together something at the Blue Note with McBride, Joey, Kurt Rosenwinkel, and Little John. They all went to high school together.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Yeah, we all are here. So then, from that, Joey said, well, hey, man, we should just do more of these. So the band is actually Little John, Joey, and Kevin Eubanks and I.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, it's going to be just really a good time just playing and hanging and playing some music.
What is it like for you to play piano over a B3 organ? I mean, that's kind of unusual, isn't it?
It is, but it's something, you know, I've been a Joey's probably 3 years older than me. Yeah, three. Mm-hmm. So I've always been a fan, and I've always been a fan of his piano playing, actually. Mm-hmm. And organ playing, without a doubt. But I love when he plays piano, mm-hmm. you know, too. So I've listened enough, I hope, and learned to kind of just, you know, not step on his toes, and he doesn't step on my toes. And we've only done it twice. So now, you know, going into April, we have about three more gigs coming up this year. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. This would be a nice little thing, totally different, like you were talking about it, totally different than the trio, totally different than the quartet. And I'm looking forward to it. Just three or four guys having fun on the bandstand from Philly with that relationship.
That is really cool. We need to get that into Chicago sometime too, boy. That would be incredible. I know Joey comes through, you come through, so maybe we'll have to hook it all up on one weekend and have a whole blowout up there at the Green Mill sometime down the road. That's for sure. That'd be incredible.
That would be great. That would be.
Well, hey, I appreciate you jumping on, and man, this has been fun. It's a pleasure talking to you and meeting you over the phone, and hopefully I will get to meet you in person. I'm going to definitely try to get up there on the 13th or 14th to see a set or two and hang out a little bit. So sure. I appreciate you being on, Orin, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Chicago.
Thank you.
And, of course, everybody can hear more podcasts at ChicagoJazz.com, ChicagoJazzMagazine.com. And until next time, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the scene.